I'm William Cooper, and you're listening to the Hour of the Time. Have you ever been outside on a beautiful day? Maybe you've gone on a picnic. The sun is shining. There's not a cloud in the sky. Beautiful. Blue sky. Nice warmth upon your skin. And then without warning, it seems like within just a few moments, fingers of clouds emanating from a single point on the horizon branch across the sky. And then, ladies and gentlemen, it rains for 3 days. You know, there have been a lot of good books written and a lot of really hair-raising, spine-tingling motion pictures made about mad scientists working in dark castles on the top of some hill in Transylvania. Not many are made about the mad scientists who, even though they don't have the disheveled look and the one eye pointing north and the other one pointing south, hair growing out of his ears, and sort of the stooped attitude of deformation of many years working over a bench in a laboratory. Nevertheless, they are just as mad. Who work in modern laboratories, spick and span, scrubbed clean, sometimes in places called Silicon Valley, or Lawrence Livermore, or Los Alamos, a national laboratory, or Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and many, many others. Working on top secret classified projects for God knows who. And I can tell you that that is usually the case. Only God knows who. Because when you get into these black budget operations, they're classified top secret and they are compartmentalized. Now, you've heard about 30 levels above top secret and all that bullshit, and that's exactly what it is. There's no such thing. There is for official use only, there is confidential, there is secret, there is top secret, there is Q. To have a Q, you must have a top secret clearance. Q simply means that you have access to atomic weapons in some manner, or the information concerning atomic weapons, or the secret of atomic weapons, or how to launch atomic weapons. That's what a Q clearance is. That's all it means. Then there are other projects that are so secret that they are compartmentalized. They're called sensitive compartmentalized operations, or SCO. They are always top secret, and then there is another word attached to them, which is assigned by the originator or controller of the project. And before anyone can have access to any part of that project or the information concerning it, they must have that second clearance. For instance, top secret laundry. Doesn't matter what the word is. If they were working upon a secret atomic-powered washing machine, that might be the compartmentalizing designation for that project. Although it wouldn't really, because the classifications or code names of projects or operations are not supposed to have anything to do with what the operation or the project is concerned with, so as not to inadvertently give it away. So it wouldn't be named top secret dirt either, because dirt might give somebody the idea that you are making an atomic-powered washing machine. But all that is neither here nor there. Then there is a further compartmentalization called eyes only. And for something to be eyes only, you don't even have to have a security clearance, and whatever it is that is classified eyes only doesn't even have to be classified information. But in the big national security apparatus, the way it works is the originator controls the classification. Now, a lot of people in the government don't know this, but anyone can classify anything that they so desire until such time as it comes up for review by someone who is their superior, who has the capability to decide whether or not it really needs to be classified and should be downgraded. It will remain classified at the level that the originator classified it. So whether or not something was actually classified for official use only, confidential, secret, or top secret, Q, are sensitive compartmentalized information, or eyes only, if I were the originator, and let's say it's just a drawing of Mickey Mouse, I could fold that drawing up, put it in an envelope, label it eyes only, and address it to an individual, and technically, and in reality, anyone other than the individual that that envelope is addressed to who opens it is in violation of the National Security Act and could be courts-martialed or, if they were a civilian in government service, tried and, if found guilty, convicted and sent to prison. So there are a lot of things classified that should not be classified. There are other things that should legitimately be classified. And there are a lot of things, most of which are classified not to protect us from some enemy, nor to keep it out of the hands of some foreign government or some foreign military force, but to conceal it from the American people. There are an awful lot of things that fall into that category, and I'm not going to get into any of those things now. But I did want to explain to you the method and the buzzwords for the classification of secret information within the government and the military. When you hear yo-yos out there talking to you about it's classified 42 levels above top secret and even the president doesn't get to see it. Well, folks, the part about the president not getting to see it is sometimes true, but the 42 levels above top secret is absolute blatherwacky. And yes, there are things that the president cannot see, because there is also, ladies and gentlemen, in fact, there's a lot of things in the government the president doesn't know about and never will know about that's classified, that he probably should know about if he's a real president and really cares about the country. But you see, there's another thing attached to it. Even if you have the clearance, and even if you have the code word that allows you access to that particular sensitive compartmentalized project or operation or information, you still can't see it unless you have the need to know. You must have an absolute need to know in the performance of your job in order to see or hear about or know about or participate in that particular information. So unless the president has a need, for instance, to know about a top secret test site in the desert where disc-shaped flying craft are being tested, he would never know, even if he served as president for two or three or four terms. Now, if something were to happen involving this technology, which caused an international incident, which came to the attention of the president, or was brought to the attention of the president, then he would be briefed. And he would only be briefed on that portion of the information that he absolutely had to know in order to be able to deal with the problem and the public and whatever foreign nations may or may not be involved. So I hope that enlightens you, and I know what I am talking about, folks, because I was attached while in the Navy to the Office of Naval Intelligence. I served on the intelligence briefing team for the Commander-in-Chief of the United States Pacific Fleet, Admiral Bernard Clary. I was the SPCAT operator for the command center when I stood watch in the command center as the senior petty officer of the watch and the man in command, literally, of the command center. Of course, underneath the officer of the deck, who was always too busy to worry about anything that happened in the command center, so we took care of all those things. It was me who handed the crypto codes. It was me who took care of the KL-47, decoded top secret, sensitive compartmentalized messages, and delivered them to the proper person in the building who was supposed to receive those messages. When I was not on watch, there was another petty officer on watch who had the same security clearance who took care of those things during his watch. While I was on watch, and during anyone's watch, there's only one person ever assigned to those types of duties. So I know about security clearances. I have seen an awful lot of top secret, Q classified information, sensitive compartmentalized information, and SI information during the course of many of the briefings we prepared for the Admiral. SI means sensitive information, which means the disclosure of the information or any part of the information could jeopardize the life of the source. And so in order to maintain our intelligence network around the world, sensitive information was closely guarded and protected so that our operatives would not be disclosed, and of course disclosure meant execution in most instances. So, just want you all to know these things so that we can deal with them, and so that you'll understand what I'm talking about when I'm talking about security clearances and the National Security Act and the National Security Apparatus and things that are classified information. I talked the other night, last night I believe it was, about weather control. And, you know, right after World War II, many things came out of the woodwork that became public. A lot of the research that was done during the war so that we could develop secret weapons and win the war were published in magazines and newspapers and in books. And a lot of the secrets of our enemies that we captured was also revealed to the public and disclosed. A lot of it wasn't, because a lot of it had import for the future and was kept secret. Some of it, of course, because of the manner in which it was captured and the people who were there when it was captured, who could not always be controlled and sometimes moved on down the line and could not be found again in order to be debriefed. Some of it, nevertheless, became public knowledge. Now, this was a time when there was a tremendous amount of scientific curiosity. There were a lot of papers published on, for instance, electrogravitics, what was called electrogravitics, electromagnetic propulsion. There were a lot of things published on alternative cures for diseases. There were a lot of experiments and articles and scientific papers written about weather control, the ability to manipulate the weather. Now, I heard about this at an early age because my father was a pilot in the United States Air Force. He was an electronics officer, and he was the officer in command of the weather shop on every base that we ever lived on. And he flew weather planes. And he and his friends would talk about what they saw in the sky and about their flying adventures and about their cadet days and about seeding the clouds to make it rain, about flying into the eyes of hurricanes to measure the the strength of the storm and the direction that it was going and all of these kinds of things. You see, back before they had all these modern electronic instruments, pilots used to actually get in planes, and my father was one of them, and they would fly through these unbelievably violent hurricanes and typhoons and thunderstorms, and so that they could get into the middle of these storms and measure the wind velocity and measure the electronic charge of the air and measure the type of ions that were present and whether or not there was hail, and it was tremendously dangerous. And sometimes they would intentionally try to get an airplane struck by lightning to see what the lightning strike would do to the airplane and all kinds of things. And so at a very young age, I listened to these stories. I heard my father talk about them. I heard them, sometimes the pilots talk about what they called UFOs, or unidentified flying objects. I heard them talk about seeding the clouds with some kind of iodine crystals. And all kinds of different things, most of which I've forgotten over the years, and except for just the remembrance of what some of these conversations are about. I really don't remember the meat of it or where it led or anything like that. I was more interested in getting outside and playing with the kids or whatever. You know, I was just a little fella. And then when I got older, and especially after having seen some classified information involving a lot of things, and specifically when I was attached to the Commander-in-Chief of the U.S. Pacific Fleet on his intelligence briefing team, I decided I didn't want to be a part of the government anymore, because all of this stuff was telling me that the world was not as I had been taught that it was, but there were things going on behind the scenes that we Americans were taught were not supposed to be going on. So I got out of the military service. I had originally intended to serve in all four of the military services, and had already served 4 years with the Strategic Air Command in the United States Air Force, working on B-52 bombers, KC-135 refueling aircraft, and Minuteman missiles as a neutralic technician, which is hydraulics and pneumatics. So I get out, and I began a life of realization of where I had been and how stupid and ignorant I had been, and I set out on a great quest for the truth. I'm looking for the Holy Grail, so to speak, and by golly, I discovered that the truth is elusive at best. It is so elusive. But you can find it if you are diligent and if you are an ethical and moral person. And if you are truly looking for the truth and not just some confirmation of your preconceived notions and beliefs and bigotry and prejudices and all of these other things, which in order to be able to search diligently and truthfully and really for the ultimate truth, whatever it may be, because I still haven't found any ultimate truth, but I found a lot of truths along the way. You have to wipe the slate clean and start all over again, as if you had never learned anything in your life. Because if you don't do that, you will spend your life trying to justify what you already believe instead of really looking for the truth. I began to see snatches of things back in the 50s and early 60s, which just disappeared at some point. There were published in the scientific literature and in the journals, the scientific journals, many, many papers about all of the things that I've been discussing tonight. And then, at some particular point, these things began to disappear. And they didn't, for instance, back in those days in popular science and popular mechanics and scientific, all the scientific journals and publications, you could just see hundreds and hundreds of these articles being written by scientists who were experimenting along these lines and trying to find ways to deal with these things. And one in particular was T. Townsend Brown, who all of a sudden, his laboratory disappeared, he disappeared, and next he turns up wearing a Navy uniform and won't talk about anything that he ever published or ever did again. And The same thing happened with all of these papers and all the experimentation on weather control. It just simply disappeared, as if someone drew a curtain across the door where all of this stuff was, and you could never look in there again. And in reality, that's exactly what happened, ladies and gentlemen. They began to become successful in their search for the ability to control these things, electrogravitics, electromagnetic propulsion, weather, scalar technology, all kinds of things that the public, by and large, has never even heard of. And most of the people who have heard of these things have heard of them from far out wacky publications and things, and really don't know much about it at all. There are a very few who have devoted their life to studying this kind of stuff and trying to draw back that curtain far enough to see what's behind it. And they know a little bit, but not much. And I'm not going to pretend to tell you that I know a whole lot about this stuff, except that I do know that it exists. I have been able to tear a little hole in that curtain big enough for me to have discovered that all of it exists, all of it is real, all of it is owned and controlled by humans, not some extraterrestrials from some other planet, and it's going to be used to control humans. And that, folks, is unfortunate, but it is reality, and reality is what we must deal with. A man by the name of Thomas F. Malone, in a book entitled Toward the Year 2018, years ago wrote a chapter in that book, Chapter 5, entitled Weather. Thomas F. Malone was the chairman of the Committee on Atmospheric Sciences of the National Academy of Sciences and vice president and director of research of the Travelers Insurance Company. This was no wacko Looney Tune guy. This isn't a guy that chases lights in the sky. This isn't some dude that just decided to sit down and write something about weather. This is a man who knew what he was talking about, well respected in the scientific community. And by the way, before I forget, lest I forget, you should all get the current issue of Popular Science, because it has an article in there to do with a huge experiment being conducted in the state of Alaska, known by the acronym of HAARP. I believe it's HAARP. And we'll talk about that on another night. And that article alleges that HAARP may be able to control the weather, amongst other things, communicating with deep submerged atomic submarines is another. Being able to locate underground munitions factories and caches of underground arms and ammunitions that somebody has buried for safekeeping. And I don't know if any of this is true or not. I'm just telling you that if you're interested in this information, that you should get this month, September, or the one that just appeared on the shelf just recently, this latest issue of Popular Science. And there is an article in there that you need to read. Also in the next issue of Veritas, the entire text of the treaty that was formalized in 1975 between the United States and Canada will be printed. We're still trying to get our hands on the one that was formalized in 1980, both of which deal with an agreement between the United States and Canada concerning weather control, promising each other that we will not use this newly developed technology on each other. And that if we use it within 200 miles of one or the other's border, that we will notify the other as to the fact that we're using it and what we're doing, so on and so forth. Now, I have to tell you, folks, if weather control did not exist, these treaties would not exist. I mean, it doesn't take a nuclear physicist to figure that out. So I'm going to read you as much as I can of this chapter 5, and I think you'll find it very interesting. and will control rain, fog, storms, and even possibly the climate, by Thomas F. Malone. This is chapter 5 in a book entitled Toward the Year 2018. In retrospect, it is clear that our approach to the problems posed by nuclear energy and space travel, which have so dominated our thoughts in recent years, has been lamentably one-sided. Although we poured truly stupendous resources of time, brains, and money into developing the technologies of these two fields, somehow we never got around to giving much consideration to the international implications of what we were doing. Had we done so, mankind might have managed certain crises of the past few decades with more wisdom and foresight, and correspondingly, the world outlook for the next 5 decades might not be so somber. Let us not make the same mistake in the field of weather and climate control. I believe the next 50 years will be crucial in the development of the technologies necessary for controlling, to a significant extent, this particularly sensitive part of our physical environment. But the coming half century will also be crucial in a much broader sense. It will be a testing period for our society. A testing period for our society. A chance for us to fashion in advance a milieu in which technical advancement can take place in the service not of narrow national aggrandizement, but of all mankind. To achieve this in regard to weather control, several steps will be required. We must deepen our understanding of the scientific problems, the opportunities it brings within reach, the limitations it imposes, and we must perfect technological dexterity where it has been developed and develop it where it does not now exist. We must assess social and economic benefits and penalties and weigh trade-offs. We must ascertain the biological consequences of deliberate intervention in the physical environment involved in ecosystems. We must resolve legal and jurisdictional complications. Above all, we must set about the difficult task of creating or adapting the international institutions that will be required if you understand, ladies and gentlemen. Let me read that last sentence again, because it's extremely important that you understand that this is another potential manipulation toward world government. Above all, we must set about the difficult task of creating are adapting the international institutions that will be required if the potential hazards to international relations are to be avoided and the opportunities are to be seized. The need for cooperation is clear. The warning flags have already been hoisted. The modest hopes and the quiet concern of the scientific community are a matter of record. The subject has been explored in both the executive and the legislative branches of the United States government. More than a decade ago, John von Neumann called attention to weather or climate modification as the kind of technological development that must be mastered through a long sequence of small, correct decisions if our society is, in his words, to survive technology. Pointing out that measures in the Arctic may control the weather in temperate regions, or measures in one temperature region critically affect one another, or another one quarter around the globe. Von Neumann concluded, all this will merge each nation's affairs with those of every other, more thoroughly than the threat of a nuclear or any other war may already have done. Similar views have been expressed by meteorologists in an invited lecture on weather modification before the 5th Congress of the World Meteorologica Organization in 1967. Academician E.K. Fedorov, chief, and get this folks, chief of the Soviet Hydrometeorological Service, remarked, quote, It is not difficult to understand that the problem of transforming the climate on a world or regional scale is, by its very nature, an international one, requiring the united efforts and the coordination of the activities of all countries. Ever more rapidly, humanity is approaching the stage in its symbiosis with nature when it can turn to practical account all the natural resources of the earth, and when, as a result, it will become capable of thinking in terms of natural phenomena on a planetary scale. It is hardly necessary to prove that, in these circumstances, all mankind should regard itself as a single whole in relation to the surrounding world. There is no other way. Of the National Academy of Sciences stated the case succinctly in 1966. It is clear that a long-range program of weather control and climate modification can have a direct bearing upon relations between nations. It can aid the economic and social advancement of the less developed countries, many of which face problems associated with hostile climates and serious imbalance in soil and water resources. And, quite importantly, it can serve to develop common interests among all nations and thus be a stimulus for new patterns of, quote, international cooperation, end quote. In addition, a special commission of the National Science Foundation presented the opportunity in these terms. Rarely has a more inviting opportunity been offered for advanced thinking and planning regarding the impact of a technological development upon international relations. In a report on weather modification and control prepared by Legislative Reference Service of the Library of Congress, at the request of Warren E. Magnuson, Chairman of the Senate Committee on Commerce, there appears this statement. Whether the increased applications of weather modification become a factor in promoting international peace or in contributing to world tensions may be determined in part by the pattern of international cooperation and regulation that is established during the current early stages of the subject. Do you hear what I said? During the current early stages of the subject. These statements would appear to provide sufficient motivation for examination of the scientific problem and some of its implications. And it tells me, ladies and gentlemen, that they were well aware of their capabilities. And remember, whatever is revealed in public is always only the tip of the iceberg. I have found that in secret there are always 50 to 100 years of whatever the public perceives as the state of the art of any technology. We may think of the atmosphere as a complex physical system in which the movement of air changes in temperature and the transformation of water into one or another of its phases, liquid, solid, and gaseous, all of considerable practical interest, and are all taking place in respect to certain forces or through particular processes. Although the atmosphere is far from being a tidy little deterministic system, in principle, we can, by altering the forces or interfering with the processes, influence the motion of air, changes in temperature, and the phase transformations of water. And in this sense, the matter of weather modification is a meaningful scientific problem, not fantasy. It is, however, a complicated one. The Earth's atmosphere may be viewed as an envelope rotating relative to the Earth as well as with it. The relative motion arises from the forces associated with both the rotation of the Earth and with sources and sinks of energy that vary in number, location, and strength. These sources and sinks depend on the distribution of shortwave solar radiation, the flux of outgoing longwave radiation, the latent heat involved in the change in phase of water, The transfer of sensible heat between the atmosphere and the underlying surface, and finally, on the air motion itself. The kinetic energy of air motion exists in an array of scale sizes that extend from planetary wave systems down to molecular movement. There is a continuous exchange of kinetic energy from one scale to another. And kinetic energy is continually being exchanged with other forms of energy in the atmosphere. The quantities of energy involved in weather systems and processes occurring naturally in the atmosphere substantially exceed the quantities under the control of man. For example, a thunderstorm may dissipate energy at the rate of 10 to the 11th power calories per second, a hurricane at the rate of 10 to the 12th power, and an extratropical cyclone at the rate of 10 to the 14th power. By comparison, the rate of production of electrical energy over all the world was 10 to the 11th power calories per second in 1962. On the other hand, the incremental energy released to the atmosphere by increasing rainfall by 1/10 of an inch over 100 square miles, which is not an unrealistic objective, is equivalent to the total output of electrical energy in the United States in a 6-day period. Thus, even though it is clear that the scientific problem of weather modification is solvable in principle, the outlook would be pessimistic for the foreseeable future were it not for two characteristics of the atmosphere: an intrinsic tendency toward certain instabilities, and the key role of the processes at the interface between the atmosphere and the underlying surface in determining the energy inputs into the atmosphere. The attribute of instability is readily apparent from everyday experience in the tendency of the amplitude of atmosphere disturbances to increase with time. For example, a small puffy type cloud may grow to a towering thunderstorm in a matter of hours. A gentle zephyr in tropical latitudes may develop into a killer hurricane in a matter of days, and a small low pressure center may grow to a vigorous extratropical cyclone within only a single day. We are just beginning to understand the instability of supercooled water droplets, which, when released, provide a local source of sensible energy. The convective instability of a rising current of air, within which water vapor is condensed into liquid, thus affecting the vertical distribution of sensible energy, and the so-called baroclinic instability of the large-scale planetary atmospheric waves, which, when released, can profoundly alter the nature of the great global system of winds. Should it turn out that the upward progression of energy through this spectrum of instabilities is a process of considerable significance, an avenue may be opened whereby relatively modest but highly selective human interventions can produce large effects. We could then break the egg rather than slay the dragon. Similarly, the sensitivity of the atmosphere to the interplay of the variables that determine the flux of energy between the atmosphere and the underlying land or water is beginning to yield to numerical analyses and field measurement. The consequences of altering surface parameters such as roughness, reflecting power, and the transfer of water across the interface is becoming known, and the possibility that these effects range beyond a local area are being explored. Some support for the line of reasoning that links small causes with large effects is found in the results of an examination of massive fluctuations in climate that have occurred in the past. Although no adequate theory of climactic change exists today, there is reason to believe that these fluctuations, some of which would be disastrous to modern civilization, may have been caused by the triggering of instabilities by natural processes through which a given climatic regime was transformed into a radically different one. For any thoughtful consideration of climactic change, it is useful to to have in mind a time scale for purposes of reference. We now know that Spaceship Earth was launched in a manner we do not yet fully understand, a little more than 5 billion years ago. Geological evidence suggests that the first elementary forms of life appeared about 3 billion years ago. The date for the first indications of prehistoric man has been receding almost yearly as new discoveries find their way into the scientific literature. But 3 million years ago appears to be the right order of magnitude. Modern man, with approximately the physical and intellectual potential of 20th century man, emerged about 50,000 years ago. The sequence of early ice ages, each of roughly 50 million years duration, that began in the late Precambrian, and that's from 700 to 800 million years ago, returned during the early Cambrian 500 million years ago, and returned once more in the Permian 230 million years ago, subjected early plant and animal life to a set of alternating stresses and relaxations that profoundly influenced evolutionary change. The salient characteristics of the ice ages included glaciers that covered 30% of continental areas and extended down to middle latitudes. Much storminess, excessively cool and wet conditions just below the middle latitudes, and a narrow belt of hot and dry conditions on either side of a warm, wet equator. During the periods between the ice ages, the permanent ice sheets disappeared, and relatively storm-free, dry, and mild conditions prevailed throughout middle latitudes. Not only man's forebears, but also man himself, have had to survive the invasion into middle latitudes of ice sheets thousands of feet thick. The most recent ice age began a million years ago, reaching a peak with the Gunai Glacial that started 600,000 years ago. Since then, we have had three glacial periods, the most recent being the Wilhelm Glacial, which appeared 150,000 years ago and ended somewhere between 10,000 and 25,000 years ago with the advent of the recent interglacial period in which we are now living. I wish scientists could think up names that people could pronounce. How do you pronounce W-I-I-R-M? I know. Somebody knows, but I don't. Climatic fluctuations similar in character but somewhat smaller in amplitude have occurred in the last 8,000 years. Mildness from 4,000 to 2,000 BC and again from 400 to 1,000 from AD 400 to 1,000 was interspersed with more stormy glacial type conditions from 1,000 BC to AD 300 and again during the 13th and 14th centuries. The characteristics of forests and vegetation, the location and migration of people, the rise and fall of civilizations in the Mediterranean and Central America, and the routes by which America was discovered were all influenced by climatic conditions. The Dust Bowl era of the 1930s, made famous by the westward migration of the, quote, Okies, unquote. The great northeastern drought of the early 1960s that compelled restrictions on water usage in New York City and the near starvation of millions in India in the mid-1960s served to remind us of man's dependence on even short-period aberrations in weather and climate. The problem of weather modification is passing from an era notable for intellectually undisciplined speculation and more or less opportunistic field experimentation, which is an admission, into an era in which rational and organized inquiry can be conducted by exploring a set of meaningful scientific questions with a combination of computerized analytical techniques and carefully designed field experimentation. This transformation has its origin in four scientific and technological developments. Now, first he talks about a possibility, and then he blatantly and clearly states this transformation has its origin in four scientific and technological developments. One, understanding of the physical processes occurring in the atmosphere has now progressed to the point at which they can be expressed in equations that constitute mathematical models. These models permit the simulation of natural processes are of particular relevance to our topic, the assessment of the consequences of human intervention in them. Although crude and oversimplified relative to the processes they are intended to simulate, useful models have been constructed of atmospheric phenomena that range in size from a single cloud to circulation of air over an entire hemisphere. There is almost unlimited potential for extension and refinement. Number two, development of the modern high-speed computer, which was encouraged initially by the computational needs of the nonlinear partial differential equations constituting the meteorological models, has proceeded simultaneously with the growth and sophistication of these atmospheric models. New generations of computers promise to bring within the realm of reality experiments by simulation that have hitherto been only a gleam in the eye of the meteorologist. Some of the more difficult problems of nonlinear instability will soon be within reach of both the speed and the capacity of computers if computers continue to increase. Our capabilities are expanding. This is number three. To make meaningful observations and measurements that specify the initial and final atmospheric conditions that must be reconciled by the computerized atmospheric models. The emerging capabilities range from the use of meteorologic satellites on a global scale to intricate measurements of the relevant physical characteristics of a single cloud. Four, significant advances have been made in the power of modern statistical procedures for resolving questions of cause and effect relationships in field experiments by establishing appropriate design criteria for both research and operational projects. The collaboration between individuals skilled in these procedures and experimental meteorologists is really only beginning, but it already promises important contributions to reducing ambiguity in the interpretation of weather modification activities. Now, taken together, these four advances provide the basis for believing that the exploration of weather modification has reached a takeoff point from which further progress will take place at an accelerating rate. Quite clearly, within the next decade or so, it will become possible to explore through simulation techniques an almost unlimited array of deliberate interventions in natural atmospheric processes and to assess possibilities and limitations. These studies will inevitably lead to specific requirements for meteorological measurements and carefully designed field experiments that will deepen our understanding of natural processes and test the efficacy of intervention in them. Mathematical models of the atmosphere have already been used in a preliminary way to assess the consequences of the inadvertent intervention associated with the increase of atmospheric carbon dioxide. These models can be used to define the tolerable limits to this large-scale geophysical experiment that mankind is undertaking, or, alternatively, to determine desirable countervailing measures. At the risk of oversimplification, and with the usual caveats about fallibility, the present position and some judgmental evaluations of the future prospects for weather modification can be summarized as follows. Now, folks, remember this book was written many years ago. This is 1995. This book was written in the 1960s, shortly after the veil of national security descended down to hide everything concerning weather modification. 1. Field results have demonstrated unequivocally that several cubic miles of supercooled clouds, or liquid cloud droplets at temperatures below freezing, can be transformed into ice crystal clouds by seeding with appropriate chemicals. The technology for performing this kind of weather modification will be perfected rapidly over the next decade. 2. Dissipation of supercooled fog over an airfield runway is now operationally feasible and has been used to good economic advantage by airlines in the United States and in other nations. Further improvement in technique will likely affect only the economics, not the efficacy, of this control measure. 3. Recent experimentation in clearing certain types of warm fog, that's droplets at temperatures above freezing, over airports, is beginning to produce encouraging results. An important breakthrough in this type, highly localized weather control, is likely to be realized in a matter of years. 4. Relatively little serious attention has been given to conscious interference in the processes at the interface between the atmosphere and underlying surface, beyond demonstrating that it is possible to inhibit evaporation from water surfaces and vegetation. If, as it now appears to be likely, these interface processes turn out to be important to large-scale modifications of the climate, there's a high probability that could go through explosive development in the period from 1975 to 1995. Number 5. Persuasive, although by no means conclusive, evidence suggests that rainfall can be increased through cloud seeding by from 5 to 20%, say 10%, depending upon the conditions. I'm reading from a very poor copy here, folks. There is a high probability that residual ambiguity will be resolved by 1975, and a further high probability that by 1980, naturally occurring rainfall can be either augmented or diminished locally by proved techniques. The probability is high that by 1993, rainfall several hundred miles downwind from the site of the operations can be increased or decreased at will. And I'll continue this tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen, because I think it's extremely interesting, and I think a lot of you find it that way also. And you've asked for it over and over and over again, so we're going to do it. Good night, folks, and God bless each and every single one of you.